We're going to drill down on one of the one another's in this section here. Let me read to you verses 19 to 25, and we're going to look in more detail at verses 24 and 25. Therefore, brothers and sisters, since we have confidence to enter the most holy place by the blood of Jesus, by a new and living way opened for us through the curtain that is his body, and since we have a great priest over the house of God, let us draw near to God with a sincere heart and with the full assurance that faith brings, having our hearts sprinkled to cleanse us from a guilty conscience and having our bodies washed with pure water. Let us hold unswervingly to the hope we profess, for he who promised is faithful, and let us consider how we may spur one another on towards love and good deeds, not giving up meeting together as some are in the habit of doing, but encouraging one another, and all the more as you see the day approaching. This whole section of Hebrews is brilliantly, logically, passionately written, and you'll see here there are three great let us. Let us draw near in faith. Let us hold on to hope. And if you know how your New Testament works, the third one's got to be faith, hope, and love. And there we are. It's a common echo throughout: faith, hope, and love. So three great let us. And faith, so what do we do? If that's true, if we've got trust in Jesus and he gives us every grounds for that, we have confidence. Our faith is not in our faith. Our faith is in what he's done. And so he explains, doesn't he? What has Jesus done? Well, he's opened up a new and living way. The forgiveness of our sins is based on what he's done for us, the blood of Jesus. And because he still lives, we are welcomed in, and we can draw near to God with a sincere heart and having our consciences put at peace. So what do we do if we draw near in faith? We, as a church, we'd pray. We would pray. That's what Jesus has done, all that so that we can draw near to God. Now, we draw near to God in our worship, but we draw especially close, don't we, when we pray. We come to God's throne. And then hope. You know how it is. Do you think England are going to win the Cricket World Cup? Oh, I hope so. You know? And after yesterday, oh my goodness, I hope so. But hope isn't like that in the Bible at all, is it? Hope is not that classic British, oh, well, it'll be all right in the end. Hope is that, sure, it's like, I know Christmas is coming, I've just got to wait. You know, we've got 8 grandchildren, and the 3-year-olds have worked Christmas out now. And they are so excited. When they were 1 and 2, clueless. But now they're kind of like, oh, Christmas, right. All you got to do if you're a child is wait long enough, it'll come. It's coming. Of course mum and dad are going to buy presents. Of course they are. There's no doubt about it. Hope is what you know is coming. It's not like, oh, is there going to be a Christmas this year? Oh, do you think so? Maybe, hope so. No, I know Christmas is coming. Just got to wait. Now in February, that's a long wait. But it's sure and certain. And we have got that sure and certain. We can hold unswervingly. For he who promises faithful. So where do we look in the direction of our lives? We look to Jesus. We look to heaven. This is, you know, heaven is our home. We're going home. Homeward bound. That famous duo song, Homeward Bound. And we need to encourage ourselves with that, because it's easy to make this place our home, but it'll always break our hearts, won't it, if this is our home? No, heaven's our home, and God gives us lovely things on the journey, but heaven is our home. And so we keep looking there. We know where our lives are going. We're homeward bound. And then finally, let us spur one another on to love. And how do we show that? Well, we're going to unpack that. That's what we're going to look at. How can we help one another? Let us. Consider how we may spur one another on towards love and good deeds. And then you'll notice what the author then does quite brilliantly. He says, okay, faith, hope, love. And the chapter headings, well, you'll see chapter 11, it's all about faith. And then chapter 12, you see how it opens. God willing, I'm preaching on this in the morning. Hebrews 12, since we've got this great cloud of witness, let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us, fixing our eyes on Jesus. We're homeward bound, and that whole chapter is about being God's children, heading to his presence. It's about our hope. And then chapter 13, notice what he starts with, chapter 13, verse 1, keeping on loving. How you love your brothers and sisters, how you love your spouse, how you love your leaders, how you love Jesus. So he unpacks faith, hope, and love, which he touches on in the section that we're looking at. He then unpacks them in a lot more detail. So we're just touching on it here. We're not unpacking it. But he does pack a lot in just in his summary, doesn't he? So let's look at our couple of verses. So let us consider. Okay, what does consider mean? Tell me, what does consider mean? What? Think, evaluate, ponder, work it out, chew over. So interesting, isn't it? We tend, in our culture, love if it's spontaneous, if it's romantic, if it's a nice feeling. But he says, no. If you really want to love one another, you've got to start with thinking about it. Not in some kind of mathematical exercise, but not just leaving it to your feelings. So we've been sort of sold the lie, really, isn't it? If your feelings are up, then that's very loving. But if you really have to use your brain and think about it and then shape your will, that isn't very loving. So no, you need to consider. You need to give it some thought. And it will mean looking at my lifestyle, the choices I make, the habits I develop, the rhythms of my life. We're not just blown around. We've got certain rhythms imposed on us, but we also have choice. So we've got to consider it. We've got to think about it. We've got to reflect on it. So what will that mean for a husband and wife? How do you reflect on things like that? Talk about it. You've got to talk about it. It won't just spontaneously happen. We use this phrase at home, we've got to get intentional. There's only so much time. We've all got exactly the same amount of time, haven't we? There's 24 hours in the day for all of us. What's the difference between us? How we choose to spend our time. So as a husband, you've got to, like, you won't have people in your home unless you talk about it. Who could we have around next week? Or do you think we've had too many people recently? Are you getting, or haven't we had enough? That's not going to just happen. And spontaneously go, oh yeah, today is the day. You go, like, let's think about it. For us, it's like, well, let's put some more. You know, sometimes we go to church not knowing who we're going to ask back, so we just put a load of potatoes on, and if they're not used up, they're fried potatoes on Monday. You know that? There's sometimes embarrassing times when we've asked people back thinking we got the timer on, and we forgot to put the chicken in. Have you ever done that? You put the timer on, you get in, you think, oh, I can feel the heat, but I can't smell the smell. And you open up, oh no, we didn't put the chicken in. Oh, well, it's going to be fish fingers then, you know, it's all right. But you got, most of the time you think about it, don't you, as husbands and wives. As parents, with children, you've got to think about it. Okay, consider is the first word. Let us think. All right, next word, spur. Tell me, what's that word, spur? Encourage. What? Tell me, let's get a bit more basic. Now, it's not in the original Greek the same word, but nevertheless, the idea is there. What is a spur? It's a pointy thing that you stick in a horse. Yeah. Now, if you're a railway buff, a spur is a branch line, okay? But if you're not, everybody else, a spur is a thing you put on the back of your ankle, isn't it? And it's sharp and pointy, and you kick a horse with it. But why would you do that? Encourage the horse. Does it encourage the horse? It gets it going. It's like, put your foot on the gas for a horse. You just give it a kick. Poof, off you go. Okay. How might you spur somebody? Yeah, it's like, come on in, outside. It's incredible. The word has that. It has the energy of pick a fight. It's the energy of pick a fight. So we're thinking we might pick a fight with every other. No. But it's that love in a church will not happen by just waiting for it to happen. Okay? It's got to be active. And what action do you need to take? Well, it's got to be deliberate. It's got to be, the word means provoke. Now, you know what it is to be provoked, doesn't it? What happens when you get provoked? Angry, yes, reactive. Any other word association with being provoked? Defensive. It gets to your feelings, doesn't it? We've just been thinking about love, but let's not leave it as a cerebral puzzle in the mind. I'm thinking how we can stir somebody, stir them up. And normally those feelings of being provoked, it's anger, it's, oh, you know, boy, it's really got me. You know, bristles on the red face. If you took the blood pressure, it's just, you know, it's all that. But to, you stir somebody up to, and this is incredible thing, isn't it? You spur somebody to love. So what the author is saying is, look, you've got to engage the brain and you've got to put energy. Love in a church has to have energy input. It isn't just, oh, it's so lovely, everybody's so lovely. You know, just easy. It just happens. We're just a wonderful community. No, no. He says, well, I don't know what church you're in, but it's in the church I'm in. The church I'm in is most of us, default mode of the human heart is what? Selfishness. Default mode of the human heart is selfishness, isn't it? What's in it for me? What am I getting out of it? Nobody's talked to me. Nobody said hello to me. And you go, did you talk hello to anybody? Oh, no, of course I didn't. But nobody said. Do you know what I mean? If we don't stir ourselves, we will be passively waiting for other people all the time. There was a whole load of stuff a few years ago in the counselling literature. It said, what you need to do is to be unconditionally loved. And if you only knew you were unconditionally loved, you'd be fine as it. You'd feel good about yourself and all the rest of it. And the great problem is like, yeah, okay, how many people are out there able to do that? Because everybody's saying, I need to be unconditionally loved. Everybody was taught to be passive. Wait for somebody else to come and love you. Well, we live in a world of 6,000 million people that all go, please come and love me. And there aren't loads of people over with tons of unconditional love to give away. No, we have to say to ourselves, every one of us, if our church is to be a loving church, we can't just sit back and wait. We've got to think about how we might put energy in, all the energy you'd put in to pick a fight, but to love. Now, some of us know this, don't we? Have you heard the phrase, the five love languages? Have you heard of the five love languages? Let me give you an example. Jenny is a farmer's daughter. What does that mean? Well, it means this. If I give Jenny a bunch of, I'm so glad you haven't done it. If I gave her a bunch of cut flowers, she looks at it and goes, what a waste of money. It won't grow. It'll be dead in 2 days. Why did you do that, Ray? Well, I said, because I love you. Well, that isn't loving me at all. If you bought me a flowering plant, or helped me with the dishes, even better. But, you know, her love language is not flowers. So I have to think, what is my wife's love language? So it could have been my love language. Well, my mum got flowers from my dad, and she thought he was wonderful. Well, it doesn't do it for me, you see? And see, even in a marriage, you have to think, like, what would really help my spouse? What is the way that she understands me expressing love? What would make a difference to her? Can I tell this story? It's a lovely story. It was an American preacher called John Ortberg. And his wife says to, you know, he's saying, like, you know, he brought her a gift home. And she said, oh, John, you know, it's so kind of you to give me a gift. But really, dear, I just used to love it when you help bath the kids, and I feel so close to you. And, you know, I really know you love me and I love you when you do things like that for me. And he said, I raced out into the hall, shouted upstairs, kids, get in the bath. They shout back, but we're 15 and 19. I don't care. Get in the bath. You know, it was like, yeah, it was brilliant. What is the love language of people in the church? For some people, could we talk? For some people is, could you help me with a task? For some people, you know, I just find it encouraging. I've got one lady at our church, she's such a great singer that she's got a whole load of people around her who's like, if I can hear Helen sing, it just helps me to worship God. Her contribution is the way that she encourages others to worship. But it needs thought, it needs understanding, it needs energy input. So let's consider how we may spur one another on towards love. Now let's talk a bit more about love. What do we know about love in the New Testament? Costly? Yeah, definitely costly. Yes, so it's not primarily a feeling. It's a commitment. It's an action thing, isn't it? It's not like, oh, I feel I love you. No, God so loved the world that he gave. This is how God showed his love amongst us. He gave his son to be the propitiation, the one that takes away his wrath. It's an attitude in action, isn't it? Let's look at that lovely passage in 1 Corinthians. This is hugely instructive, isn't it? Thank you very much. So how many of you have ever heard that at a wedding? Most of us. Yeah, and we think, oh, isn't that lovely? Oh, it's lovely. Just the right thing for a wedding. If you were in Corinth and that was heard, you'd be red with shame. You would be going, oh my goodness, that is a very major, I'm not using it in a horror way, but it's a very major telling off. You write a chapter like that to a bunch of Christians because the very opposite is happening. In fact, there's often a giveaway. When you see something in the Bible, like, why is that there? Because the opposite is happening. Okay, so there's a church full of people boasting about what gifts they've got, full of forgetting about other people, full of putting themselves at the front, full of being impatient, unkind, jealous, proud, putting others down, putting myself first, getting very touchy very quickly, remembering things for ages and ages and ages ago, almost glad when things go wrong for somebody else. Let them sort it out, it's their problem. Suspicious of everybody, writing little stories in my head about why they did what they did, and I'm sure it was wrong. And feeling like, what is the point of coming to this church? Now, I have been in churches that is true of all those things. They're not absolutely up there on the front, but they're there just beneath the surface. 1 Corinthians 13 is written because the church has lost. It's lost this. And in one sense, if the church doesn't ever want to get to the stage where it needs 1 Corinthians 13 written to it, it has to do Hebrews 10. So if you don't do the Hebrews 10, spur one another on, consider how you can spur one another on to love, you'll end up one day having to have 1 Corinthians 13 written to you. Because the default mode of the heart, those things are how sinful people act easily. These things just happen. It's a bit like my daughter's moved out home. She's got a house, lovely, and 4 or 5 years ago. And she's just remembering that gardens grow. And what grows in gardens? Weeds grow. We even later, it got so bad, she got a lady in 1 year to cut all the weeds down. And she thought, right, Dad, I've sorted the weeds out. The lady came in, I paid her a fortune to get all the weeds. Within a year, the weeds are grown again. So we said, right, what we're going to do, we're going to put a load of weed killer down. We're going to get rid of all your grass, and we will turf your garden. So So you make sure you look after it. And she assumed that because her garden is turfed with grass, that she doesn't need to ever look at it again, ever. Not cut it, not weed it, nothing. Well, she's learning that weeds grow. They just do. You don't have to sow weeds. You don't have to pray for the rain for the weeds. The weeds will just grow. Well, that's 1 Corinthians 13. That will happen in a Christian church easily. The opposite of everything he said. And because we read 1 Corinthians 13, go, oh, isn't that lovely? We don't reflect on, are you a patient person with somebody in the church who's just messed up? And I've seen so many Christians like that. I've been on holidays. Have you ever been on holiday with a Christian group and they're telling off people who're serving them in the hotel? And I think, oh no, we're the Christians. Oh, my breakfast is late. And you go, for goodness sake, be patient. Well, oh. And you think, what's happening is you're not in your normal circumstance. And actually, what's there is coming out. And that's what comes out. And you watch out for that. Sometimes some of us have to work. Sometimes having a Christian in the team or in the office is just so embarrassing. Because they're not on home turf where everybody's working. So they just revert to being impatient, touchy, easily angered, quite frustrated, demanding a refund. And you think, oh my word. I wonder what's just beneath the surface is a load of weeds. So we need to get that stuff out and replace it with an active commitment to doing those very things. Thinking the best of our brothers and sisters. I spoke not long ago. Do you know when the Joseph and his brothers, you know, and before they knew who he was, and he invites them for a banquet. And this is what happens. And his brothers think, you know, this speech bubble, he's inviting us to his place to kill us. That's what they think. They think the worst. They invent a story in their head. And I just talked about how many of you invent stories in your head on no evidence at all. And so let me tell you what I mean. It's like you sent a text and another one hasn't come back. And oh, I must have upset her. Well, she hasn't said thank you for thanking me for thanking her for our last text. What is going on there? Maybe, and exactly the same thing. Everyone laugh because everyone's like, I do that. She hasn't got back to me. I've upset her. I was like, let's go for the evidence. When you meet her next time, say, oh, you didn't get back to me. Oh, no, I lost my phone. And they think, yeah, you lost your phone. And my wife has written this story in her head that somehow she must have upset you so that you didn't get back to her immediately on when she thanked you for thanking her on the text stuff. See, we do that all the time. We make up stories in our heads. We do the 1 Corinthians 13 thing. So we need to say, don't make up stories. What does love always do? Love always trusts. Love always protects. Love always hopes. Love always perseveres. Love thinks the best of others. We don't write the worst case scenario story. Oh, I'm sure they blanked me this morning because they don't like me anymore. Now that stuff goes on in church life all the time. Hebrews says, don't let that. Instead, do the opposite. Put energy into love, which is an internal thing that then issues in good deeds. You need energy to see good deeds in a church. Now, we know what good deeds are. Let's turn to 1 Timothy 5. We're just given a list there. Yeah. Now, this Paul's saying, look, we're out to help widows, but we're not going to be conned. We're not going to be taken for a ride. So these are genuinely needy people who are Jesus's people. And how would you know that? Well, there's a couple of qualifications. She's got to be over 60. So not a young widow who could remarry, but an old widow who's in desperate need. She's not got Christians in her family. He's already dealt with that earlier in chapter 5. If anyone has got a widow in the family, they look after them. These are the widows who've not got Christians in the family who are really needy. And then this series of, look, we know she belongs to Jesus because of look at her life. Her life is marked by her good deeds. And he gives us some examples, bringing up children, showing hospitality, serving in a menial way, helping those in trouble, not avoiding those in trouble, and devoting herself to all kinds of good deeds. Now that's specific, but you can see the point. What would it look like for you to be devoted to good deeds at your age and stage? What does it look like going be above and beyond. Years and years and years ago, in the, an age when churches still had hymn books, yeah, and I was a very junior, but the guy who was helping train me said, okay, Ray, when you come to look for the next generation of leaders, what do you look for? I don't know. He said, let me tell you, look for the guys that pick up the hymn books without being asked. What? What? He said, there will be many people who want to be the platform, but what you want to do is look for the servants. And the real servants are the ones you don't have to go around asking. They just do it. They just know it needs to be done. Anybody could do it. It's menial, and they'll do it without being asked. I thought, what an insight. Remember when Jesus said to Peter, would you row out? You know that Jesus is preaching, and he says, oh, Peter, he gets in the boat. Let me borrow your boat. Would you just row out so I can preach to the crowds? Now, look, Peter's a fisherman. Jesus is a carpenter by this time, okay? As far as he knows, a carpenter. He could have said, look, I know you're only a carpenter, but you row your own boat out. It's only 10 yards. Any idiot can do that. I have just worked what? All night, and I've caught nothing, and I'm absolutely knackered. So no, I'm not. Row your own boat. But Peter was just given a menial task to do, and he did it. Row your boat. Yes, all right, Jesus, I'll row the boat out. And then Peter was saying, now, can you obey orders? Having done the menial task, Jesus then tested him even further. Are you willing to do as you're told? Put the nets down on the other side. Do you remember how the story goes? Yeah, we've worked all night, caught nothing, but because you say so, I will. What a great test of character that, isn't it? Are you willing to do menial tasks and just do as you're asked, just because you're asked to by somebody else? That's what good deeds often looks like in practice in a church, isn't it? It's not. There's not fanfare. Dan, 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 dan. Ray is going to do a good deed now. Let's all applaud him. It don't work like that, does it? Most of the stuff that makes church work, which makes family life work. You know what it is? Sometimes you're like, oh, somebody's emptied the dishwasher. Oh, isn't that lovely? You know, it's just somebody's done it. Somebody's got the washing in when it was raining. Didn't have to ask. Somebody has helped vacuum the I don't know what it is. Family life works when people just get on with it. Church life's the same. That's what good deeds looks like. But then he gives us a couple of other things, doesn't he? Verse 25. What's the negative we've got to avoid? Don't give up meeting together. Now notice the words, not give up meeting together as some are in the habit of doing. That's really interesting, you see. Some people give up on Christianity because they reject Jesus. They forsake Jesus, or they forsake the church. He's not talking about people who do that. He's talking about people who drift away slowly, slowly. These are not people who are denying the faith. Although, you notice verse 26, the warning, soon as he says that, if we deliberately keep on sinning, if we deliberately keep on doing what we know God does not want, we put ourselves in great jeopardy. But here he's saying, look, watch out for drift. Now, let me just tell you something about what's happening in Britain today. One of the guys I work for, FIC, the FIEC, this group of churches, used to say, I wonder how many people go to FIEC churches. And so they used to send a questionnaire out and say, on a Sunday, normally it was in October, because they reckon October was a good month, most people are going to be there. If they're ever going to be there, they're going to be there in October. Count the number of people that come to church on October the 23rd. And they did. And I used to fill in a form, and I wrote and said, Andrew, it doesn't work like that. He said, what do you mean? He said, I reckon on any one Sunday, 20% of our folks are away on any one Sunday. They're taking kids to uni, they're working, they're sick, they're on holiday, they're going to somebody's stag do. You know, there's just anyone. If you ask me how many people come to our church on any one Sunday, it's not the number of people I have to look after. And then he thought, oh, I wonder what that looks like then. So they did a questionnaire. and they interviewed over 100 churches and say, how many people come to your church on a kind of monthly basis? And what they found was a very interesting statistic. The smaller the church, the smaller the percentage of people away on any one Sunday. So in my brother-in-law's church, where there's about 19 members, isn't there now? 19. Nobody can be away without consultation. You going on holiday? You can't go on holiday then. If you go on holiday then, oh, I can't go. And so the church kind of has this, like, we all compare notes on when we're going to be away. In fact, we can never get him to come over our church. He said, oh, I can't come away to the church, Ray, because I'm needed back at home. He's one of the elders of the church. And he said, I can only get away about 4 Sundays a year, and coming to Bedford doesn't count, so I'm sorry, I can never come. Like, what? Now there's a sociological thing going on there. It's not that spiritual. Don't think it's that spiritual. Just numbers. If you're in a small group, you cannot have that many people away. Thing just disintegrates. So what they found in small churches are, on any one Sunday, about 3 to 5% of people away. Then you get to a church of about 70, goes up to about 7 or 8%. And then a church of about your size, it'll be about 10, 12% away. And on it goes. This relationship goes like that. So in a church of 400, 25 to 30% of people are away on any one Sunday. And you go, oh, that's terrible. Those big we don't want to be one of those big churches where people are consumers. They just turn up when they feel like it. No, it's much more complicated than that. A big church will often reach the kind of people that a church of 20 won't reach. So it might reach high-powered businessmen around the country 3 times out of 5. Or it might reach single mums who, with the best will in the world, can only get 2 Sundays a month because it's just chaos. It might meet more divorcees and Sunday morning is the handover and it's very painful and very difficult sometimes. It's going to reach the kinds of people that a small church wouldn't reach. And those people away, they're not often away for bad reasons. It also might be reaching more people in their early 20s. What happens to people in their early 20s? They get married. That's not the problem. The problem is all their friends are getting married. What does that mean? Well, when I was a young man, I didn't know what a stag do was. We didn't have one. There wasn't a hen party. You just got married. There was no evening do. I mean, what do you mean there was a marriage with no evening do? There wasn't an evening do. We just got married in the afternoon, had a family, basically family and a few friends, and we got left War Boys at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and we arrived where we were staying on holiday in Devon, 10:30 at night or whatever. And that was the wedding. Was today? Today. Now, if you're your age, how many mates you got? Oh, all my friends from uni getting married. How many of them? Oh, loads of them. You're going to a hen do. You're going to a stag do. You're going to the wedding weekend. And you're doing it 6 times a year for the next 10 years. Oh. Now, if you're in a church where you've got loads and loads and loads of people in their 20s, they're always away. What are you doing? And then what happens then? What happens then when they get married? Well, you know what happens. The babies come. What happens then? Oh, there's a baby dedication. How many of them? Oh, no. How many kids they got? 5. Oh, no. And so that. Now, would you say you can't do that? You can't do that. You're nice. Tut, 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 tut. Now, a small church says, well, all right, you can go as long as you're back for Sunday. Well, okay. I understand that. But they're getting married in Aberdeen. Oh, your problem. You know, perhaps more seriously, one of the hardest things today, many of us coming from broken homes. Many of us coming from broken homes now. The generation under 30 are the highest rate of people come from broken homes ever in the history of the land. But what does that mean? Well, it often means this. I married you. Your mum and dad have split up. My mum and dad have split up. We've had children. How many sets of grandparents there are? There are 4. Do grandparents want to see grandchildren? You bet they do. Right? Well, we've got 4 sets of grandparents. They live all over the place. How often do the grandparents want to see the grandchildren? Well, as many times as they can. So you'll often find a young couple with, say, 3 children will be away visiting grandparents. The grandparents all can't come at the same time to our house because that's like, uh-oh, no, no. Dad is and you know, it's just, and that's just the fact of life. So what happens, it's not necessary tut, 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 all these people skybing church. It can be genuine, But also it can be a habit. It can be a habit that people slip into. I'll get to church when I can. Becomes a, I get to church sometimes, then I get to church rarely, then I get to church not at all. It's a drift, isn't it? Now, it's a really difficult problem today because of modern, you know, modern social reality as well as modern technological reality. But it's also a problem because of the habits of our hearts. Britain, as you know, when I was a boy, what happened on Sunday? Absolutely nothing. There was no telly. There was no shops. There was no... When's the Wimbledon final now? Sundays. There was no sport. There was nothing. And it was very easy to say, well, come to church morning and evening because that's a good habit to get into. Now, there's nothing in the Bible that says you must come to church morning and evening. You know, there's nothing in the Bible that says how long should the meeting be, what time and day should it be, you know, blah, 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 blah. It's not. It's don't give up the meeting together. But what's happened in Britain, slowly, is we've lost evening meetings completely. Many, many churches don't have evening meetings. Now, that's, I understand that, but what do people do if you haven't got an evening meeting? Honest. Go to the pub. Watch telly. Sleep. Yeah. Those kind of, now, those things are not necessarily wrong in themselves. But what happens if you don't have a morning and evening pattern? Now, look, I'm not getting too on a hobby horse about this one, but it's just, I've noticed this. If you only have a morning meeting, if you've got any number of single people, unless your church is phenomenally committed to hospitality, Sunday can be an extremely long day if you're a single Christian. If you're a shift worker and you can't make a morning meeting, that's a Sunday gone. You've got Lister near here, haven't you? We've got Bedford General Hospital. We have a load of doctors and loads of nurses. They work shifts all the time. They are so grateful we've got an evening pattern. We have a whole load of kids. Now, that's not too bad in the meeting. What happens if you... Oh, we have four kids. We've had 15 babies born in the last, I don't know, 15 months, I suppose, and there's loads on the way. After our church service, it's extremely noisy. And kids are running around like maniacs. Now, when you're a parent, you're like, oh, no, that's mine. I can hear him a mile away. And, you know, you can't really talk to anybody after the service because you're really having to watch. Like, and look, if your kids are still like little toddlers, you want to be grateful. You want to wait till they're a bit older. When we were meeting in a school, my 12 and 10-year-old, what would they do after a service at a school on a Sunday? They'd be on the roofs looking for the footballs that got kicked up there during the week. And they were always getting told off. And I was like, oh, Ray, your kids are on the roofs again. Oh, no. And, you know, almost like, let's get out of here and get home quick. And what we've said at home is, look, morning meetings is always going to be, when you're a parent and you've got toddlers, several of them, your mind's on them, even if there's a creche. Whereas the evening meeting is almost a young child-free zone. You can come to our evening meeting, husband and wife, take it in turns, come to the evening meeting. There's still a good crowd at our evening meeting. We get a good crowd at our evening meeting. It's one of those things, if everybody makes the effort, everybody thinks it's worth it. Well, we've got several churches in town with 700 or 800 people. They were getting less than 30 in the evening, so they can the evening. And that was a shame because it just died because... thought, well, if you're not going to go, I won't go. Whereas if we work it the other way around, if you're going to go, I'll go. So for our single people, it's not a lonely day. For our shift workers, there's something to come to. For our young marrieds, at least one of them gets a decent conversation on a Sunday. For growing children, we used to say, okay, now let me, what, you may be watching telly, but where's your 14-year-old going to be? Internet? Or out with friends. We had a couple, a lovely couple, a really lovely couple. They had five children, and they said, like, Ray, we understand the church has this evening thing, but we have a family time on a Sunday night. Okay, But I always thought, do you know what? I think you're not setting a good habit, because what you're teaching your children to do is that Sunday morning is what we go to and Sunday evening is an optional extra. They don't have to go. And they have this lovely family time. I thought, yeah, that will be till they're about 12 or 13. Then they don't want to have this lovely family time, because that's something they associate with being a child. They now want to be an adult. They want to do adult-type things. And for you as a family is leave mum and dad behind with the other little ones while we go out with our friends. And that's what happened. They moved away from Bedford. They gradually, their children went going out with their friends in the evening. And each of the children made that rite of passage. That instead of saying our rite of passage is almost our 10-year-old son or 12-year-old, I guess he was 10, said to his brother, you are not allowed to the evening meeting yet, Rich, because you're not old enough. I'm going with mum. Oh. And he's like, that's not fair, mum. Why am I not allowed to go to the evening meeting? Because you're not old enough. Oh, yeah, like, they're fighting about not being allowed to come to the evening meeting. So when they come to the evening, he's like, oh, look, I'm really grown up. Oh, and then he used to say to their two sisters, oh, you're still little babies. You're not allowed to come to the evening meeting. Now, I know it's a bit applied psychology, but the rite of passage was not you are now allowed to go out with your friends on the streets. The rite of passage is you're now allowed to come to church. So for a whole load of growing children, coming to our evening meeting is a sign of, oh, wow, look at me. And now that sounds crazy. But you see, out there, there are phenomenal powers and forces taking them away from Jesus. And the amount of time you get with your children, it goes like that, doesn't it? So we've used our evening meeting to say, look, bring your 8-year-olds and get them into the habit of coming, and they have an after evening do, and we say to some of our really cool young couples, invite people back for supper, and mums and dads, don't say no because you need your sleep for school. If you get invited back by a cool young couple who are like 22 and you're a 14-year-old, the answer is always yes. Yes. Why is that? Because church cannot compete sideways. It cannot compete with the peers at school. I mean, I don't know. How many people in your school? 400. How many people of your age in this church? 4? Okay. You're outnumbered 100-1. Okay? You can't compete sideways, but you can create connection up and down. So some of my son's best friends are cool people 5 years older. Some of their best friends were 80-year-old grannies. I used to talk to them every week and say, here you are, I bought these sweets for you. I know your dad's a bit boring at night, you know. And that sense of humanity, they cried when their Auntie Ruth died. They were so hot. And these are teenage boys crying when they're 80-year-old because she had befriended them. Now, a church, say, can't compete horizontally, but can. But you can't if you just shove them out and never see them. So we used to bring our youngsters into the meeting. We tried our level best to help overcome the habit of drift. The habit of drift. So don't give up the meeting together. Now you've got to work this out for yourselves as a church. But it's one of those things. If you all go for it, everybody thinks it's a great meeting. And what happens if you come from a church? I understand this, not easy. If you come from a church where they only have a one meeting on Sunday pattern, to be asked to come twice looks like, oh my goodness, it's too much. But there are good reasons. There are really good reasons. And that's something you may have to work out for yourselves. We have been very grateful. Some of our parents are so, I'm so grateful, Ray, that you know the church has worked hard at this, because I think my youngsters would have drifted off, either, as you say, onto the internet or out with their friends. And I can't compete with that. Okay. But instead, what's the positive? Encouraging one another. Now, you did a bit of that earlier. You had some people up and heard about those ministries. There's endless ways you can encourage. One of the most helpful ways is by saying, thank you. Thank you. A few years ago, We asked our church leaders, some deacons, like, how do you think the church thinks about you? And they said, I think they see us as command and control negatives. Does that sound familiar? You know, if we see somebody And we tend to go up and say, you're doing a great job, but you know, we want it done like this, or could you do that? That thing called seagull management, have you heard about seagull management? They fly in, they squawk all over you, poo all over you, and off they go again. And so they said, that's how we feel. We're like, you know, people say, oh no, one of the deacons is coming to see me. Uh-oh, what have I done wrong now? So one of them said, you know what? I knew I would feeding that. So what I did, I took a bunch of post-it notes on the train to work, or a bunch of notelets, and I wrote thank you letters with no buts. Just, I really was so touched by your kindness yesterday. I want to know, I thank you, God, for you. Put it in the post. He did that 9 months solid, every week, 9 months. And he said, it made me feel so much more an encourager. And the people receiving these letters, like, oh, so somebody noticed. There was a survey done. They asked people in a company, if you could have a significant pay rise, but nobody knew about it, or you were going to be thanked publicly for what you do, what do you want? Nearly everybody said, thanked publicly. I want to know what I do counts. Actually, that sense of being appreciated, that sense of it matters, is more important than the money. And in church life, it's very interesting, isn't it, how Paul often writes to people, I thank God for you. Now, have you ever thought about that? He could have just thanked God. He could have just thanked God. But he told them that he thanked God. So they knew he really appreciated. Appreciation, small words of encouragement. Just thanks so much today. You've been a real encouragement to me. Or thank you for your kindness. Or just small words of encouragement go a million miles. And I don't know if you guys know this already. We are a volunteer force, okay? And I've got a friend of mine who ran a company of 300 people, and he said, I could never do your job. He said, because ultimately, what can I do? I can put somebody on report, they get a written warning, I can fire them, or I can give them a bonus, or a badge, or promotion. He said, I've got a big stick and a phenomenal carrot. What have you got? You haven't got either of those things. If you tell somebody off in church life, they'll go, all right, Ben, you do the sound system next week. I don't care. Or you get the coffee. Or you put the chairs away. Volunteers cannot be told. Somebody said this once. How do you train a killer whale? Answer, carefully. Because they bite your head off. You cannot punish a killer whale. You have to reward it. Now, volunteers are like killer whales. They are. If you discourage a volunteer, you never get them back again. You just, if you punch the life out of them, they go, it hurts too much. I'm going to pull back. And actually, church life depends on people using their discretionary time and energy and pouring it into other people. So you can't punish that. You have to, but you can't reward. There's no financial reward, is there? It has to be the reward of thank you for being a servant of God that has served us so well. Little words of encouragement go a long way. And then finally, 1 minute, and why? Why all this? Well, as he says, and all the more as you see the day. What's the day? Jesus' return. It's the return of Jesus. And notice how chapter 12 starts. Fix your eyes on Jesus. It's not so much where you're going as who you're going to meet. You know, an athlete looks at the finishing line. Or some people say, I'm going to Australia on holiday. But my friend Pete says, I'm going to see my daughter who lives in Melbourne. Okay? It's who I'm going to see more than where I'm going that matters. He's not saying, I'm going to Australia. I want to happen to see my daughter when I get there. He says, no, I'm going to see my daughter in Australia. It's a bit like, that's how heaven is. I'm going to heaven because that's where Jesus is. And when he locks eyes on me, it won't be with a scowl. It won't be with a scowl. It'll be, great to see you. Great to see you. Glad you're home now. Fix your eyes on Jesus. So why do we do all these things? Because we serve the Lord of love. And we might as well use our lives for him so that when we meet him, we brought some joy and pleasure to his heart. We're going to hear that, well done, good and faithful servant. Well done. You spurred your brothers and sisters to love and good deeds.